Welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your entrepreneurial peers on the path to self-leadership mastery and life success. Redefine how you lead as you redesign your business. I call this dual innovation leadership. Take charge of who you next become. Feel more deeply to think, act, lead, and mentor more clearly and effectively. Discover something new from our meaningful conversation today. Hi, I'm Nancy. Welcome to episode 383, What We Need to Know About Forensic Psychiatry with Dr. Mark Levy, Part 2. Today we start with finishing up from our last conversation about Mary L. Trump's book, Too Much and Not Enough. Dr. Levy describes the book as a rational roadmap into understanding the origins of Donald Trump's personality, and he discusses that a bit more. It's really wonderful insights that he shares with us. We also go into when to know when you need to see a therapist, picking a therapist, and the hallmark of a bad therapist. And we end our conversation with a deeper understanding of incivility and what we can do about it. Enjoy this conversation. Today's sponsor is Midwest Bakery, and I'm excited to tell you about their delicious all-natural halal bread. I'm so jazzed about their bread products that I'm helping them grow their bakery. They follow the Muslim definition of halal, ensuring their bread and hoagie rolls use only permissible ingredients. Check out MidwestBakeryHalal.com. That's Midwest Bakery, HALAL.com. To find a store near you. Remember, you don't need to be Muslim to enjoy their food. If they're not in a grocer near you, talk to the store director and request it. After all, grocers want to stock products that you love to eat. Now enjoy my conversation with Dr. Levy. So to refresh your memory, Dr. Mark Levy is a licensed clinical and forensic psychiatrist with over four decades of experience. Dr. Levy has been certified by the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology and the National Board of Physicians and Surgeons. He's an associate clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco, and an adjunct associate professor of psychiatry at Stanford University School of Medicine. Dr. Levy and his team of 22 board-certified psychiatrists and 10 forensic neuropsychologists practice forensic psychiatry at Forensic Psychiatric Associates LP, or the short version, fpamed.com. Dr. Levy has been retained as a forensic psychiatric expert in more than 500 civil lawsuits and related matters. He has published numerous articles and presented countless talks on forensic psychiatric topics, such as mental illness in the workplace and shrink in the courtroom, forensic psychiatry, and law. So thanks again, Mark, for joining me for today's discussion to deepen our understanding of how our behavior intersects with the law.
Pleasure to be here, Nancy. Thanks for inviting me.
Yes.
I just as a holdover from our first conversation, Mary Trump's book is called Too Much and Never Enough.
There it is.
I commend it to anyone who's listening to this podcast, because it is a roadmap, a rational roadmap into understanding the origins of Donald Trump's personality, the dynamics that underlie how he responds to various stimuli that come up today as much as they did when she was growing up in the family. And she's a very well-trained clinical psychologist who grew up in the family, whose father was the eldest brother, older than Donald Trump, who was driven by her grandfather to drink and an early death.
Yeah, that was really sad. She's an eloquent writer. I was engaged the entire book and really just felt sad of, you know, the environment that she grew up in.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the legacy that she, is trying to
She's remarkably overcome. Intact coming from that family. That's a, you know, I assume she's had many years of psychotherapy to sort out her own baggage, but she's very clear. So anyway, I commend that to anyone interested in understanding our former president's behavior.
One of the questions that I get often is when do you know when to go see someone and who do you go see? Like initially, I know this isn't about forensic psychiatry, but it's about mental health. And, you know, we've all been compromised over the years of the intensity that we've experienced. That what kinds of questions does one go through right before they realize, I think I'm going to get some help?
First of all, it's commendable when somebody reaches that conclusion, because most people, although we all, if we have trouble seeing clearly, get eyeglasses, are quite reluctant to get psychological help when we're not functioning so well. And there can be various warning signs, particularly in high-stress professionals such as small business owners. Most common is increasing reliance on alcohol or other substances to cope. And one of the things that we do as a group is consult to law firms about burnout and the particular stressors, because law is a stressful profession, and the litigation subset of lawyers are in and out of pressure cookers. And so, for example, you may find as a 20-year-old young associate in a law firm that you're drinking socially when you go out on the weekends. And then when you're in your 30s, you're kind of looking forward to 5 o'clock and getting home or going to the bar and having a glass of wine. And then in your 40s, it's more like a bottle of wine with dinner. And that progression, if it hasn't caught your attention along the way, which it usually has, but we kind of rationalize it, it is a big flashing red light that you're self-medicating problems that would be better dealt with in a way that's less detrimental to your overall physical health by sorting out how you manage stress or don't manage stress. So that can be a warning signal. I think your question is very good, not just when do you go, because I think you go if you are open to recognizing that you're having problems functioning, your personal life is getting much more conflictual. If you're married, your spouse is telling you that you're irritable or that you're not available, or you're getting feedback that you're no longer meeting their needs very well, or the children's needs, or whatever. And it takes a lot to listen to that and say, I have all kinds of explanations for why I'm doing the best I can, but maybe I should pay attention to what I'm hearing and take it under advisement. If you are that mature that you can hear this and get help, then I think the second question that you asked is, who do you go to? And that's really important, because it's very hard to know. You know, in many ways, it's like if you're having back pain and you go to an orthopedist and they say, well, you need back surgery. A careful consumer will want to be sure that either they get a second opinion, or that the source of this referral to this orthopedic surgeon was someone they clearly trust. It might be their primary care doctor who they've known for decades and have made other referrals, and they just trust their referrals. But if you're considering undergoing major surgery, you want to be sure it's the only way to treat the problem that you have. So the first thing is, what is the source of your referral? And it's hard to get sources of high quality mental health referrals. Sometimes friends will rave about their therapist, and that may be a very good indication, or it may not be. Maybe their therapist actually isn't very good, but becomes their best friend and shares across the boundary their own personal issues, and in a way is seductive in that relationship to make your friend, their patient, feel very special. That's not necessarily good treatment, but it can be a seductive treatment. So if a friend says, I'm seeing a really good therapist, then you want to evaluate how critical a thinker is that friend, and how mature an individual is that friend or not. Certainly starting with a primary care doctor is a good source. If you know someone, which you may not in the field, you may ask them who they would respect. One could always go to the local medical school and inquire in the psychiatry department. Who are the senior people in the department who are taking patients? And that can be another source. And that could be a source either of a psychologist or a psychiatrist. One of the things that's a changing, almost like a kaleidoscope right now, is do you see a psychologist or do you see a psychiatrist? And medical economics has changed psychiatry, in my judgment, most unfortunately, to being a prescribing component of mental health care rather than a good psychotherapist. And so for reasons of insurance and costing the insurance company the least possible, they divide psychotherapy and medication treatment between psychologists and psychiatrists. Psychiatrists traditionally were very well trained, and I was trained beyond psychiatry for a decade in psychoanalysis, which is a form of psychotherapeutic treatment. It's not the only form, it's certainly not for all problems, but it is an in-depth treatment and involves multi-years of treatment of the clinician, which is really important. And it's very hard to learn. If you saw someone who was psychoanalytically trained, you would know by definition of what that training involves, because I'm telling you now, that they have been treated themselves for years, not just for 6 months. The value of that is when you're a physician and you listen through a stethoscope for heart sounds, unless you're hard of hearing, there's nothing that really interferes with accurately interpreting what you're hearing. But a therapist is listening to what the person is telling them. It's not a stethoscope. And if there are problems in their own childhood or growing up years that interferes with what they hear, they distort what they hear as a result of their own baggage. And the goal in being treated is, and it's not required except in psychoanalytic training, it's not required to be licensed as a psychiatrist or to become a psychiatrist, but the goal in getting good psychotherapeutic treatment along the way is to learn your biases and learn the areas in which you may have problems being empathic. For example, I once had a patient who was a pedophile, and I had two young children, and it was very, very difficult for me to be empathic with the man, because I kept personalizing it in terms of my own family needs and the threat that he would be to my kids.
Yeah.
So that's an extreme example, but that can be true in all kinds of areas. So you want a therapist who is mature and know something about themselves so that they can be as unbiased as possible. We're all biased, but to be aware of their biases, be aware of where they tend to distort or become defensive about what they hear. And so if they've had extensive training. Credentials are important in this area. So you want, and the marketing side of mental health treatment is, I kind of jokingly call this being an expert on the left kidney. That's a nonsensical notion, but there are people who say, oh, I am an eating disorder specialist, or, you know, I am a sex addict specialist. That's nonsensical. It's as nonsensical as being an expert on the left kidney. You want someone who really understands human development and has an overarching a theory that they can use as a roadmap to understand what you're telling them is causing you pain in your life. And that is not sub-specialized down to a particular symptom. That symptom is, in fact, part of a whole group of symptoms. You know, for example, someone who has sex addiction is not very different from someone who has alcoholism or other kinds of what's called compulsive behaviors. And understanding how compulsive behaviors is a way that people assuage feelings of anxiety or depression is important. And then having the perspective to look and see, well, what is this sex addiction, perhaps sex addiction, a symptom of? Are they really defending against depression? And if you treat the depression, then that symptom will subside if you appropriately treat the depression, et cetera. You need this broad and deep perspective on human behavior in order to be an effective therapist. And then add to that the medication, because we live in an age of psychopharmaceuticals and pharmaceuticals in general, and they can be very helpful, not as the sole treatment. The best treatment for depression is antidepressants and good psychotherapy. Either alone can be helpful. For some individuals, either alone is the best. But for most people, it's a combination of the two. So, and therefore, in my judgment, the best treatment is from a single clinician who can do both, which is not in any way to discredit psychologists. And there are many psychologists who recognize, I can do the psychotherapy really well, but you also need to see your doctor to get some antidepressants, et cetera. But that, so that, who you find is, look at the source of the referral, find the best source you can, look at the credentials of the individual, and then don't hesitate to shop a little bit. Pay for a few interviews with two or three people and see with whom you resonate amongst the people who are well-credentialed, because this is a field that's full of people who are not well-credentialed, who have lots of problems of their own. And you don't want to get caught in that matrix of their own. And the hallmarks of that is not respecting the boundaries between you, the patient, and themselves, the therapist, crossing over, engaging you, telling you things about their lives, which are really not what you're coming for and not what you should be paying for, or trying to engage you in inappropriate behaviors, relationships, etc. Those are really flashing red lights that this is not someone you should be seeing.
So how does someone draw the line between like asking the therapist a little bit more versus them leading it down to a road that's a major red flag?
That's the art of psychotherapy. How you manage that boundary comes with experience and training and self-knowledge. That's a generalized answer, but let me be specific. In general, most patients are very curious about their therapists. That doesn't mean that it's necessarily helpful to them for what they're coming to the therapist to remedy to know a lot about their therapist. So how do you balance making a patient comfortable with you as a therapist and maintaining a boundary between your private life, not for the protection of the therapist, but for the reason of not interfering in the patient's life with your own stuff? How do you do that? Part of it is if you're authentic and genuinely interested in your patient, their need to know, you know, are you married? Have you had this experience before? Do you have kids? Becomes less pressing because it's clear that you really want to understand your patients, what is causing them pain. So that, from the therapist's point of view, it helps in managing it. Another is in what I consider high-quality, insight-oriented psychotherapy, and there are different kinds of psychotherapy. There's cognitive behavioral therapy, which is quite different. In insight-oriented psychotherapy, if a patient is pressing me for more information about me, I would say, you know, I'm really struck by how urgent it seems to you to know more about my personal life. What do you think that's about? How does that help you? Why is that important to you? What anxieties, really? I'm asking. What anxieties are you trying to cope with about trusting me without knowing the details of my personal life? And that would get to their basic trust issues. And it's the source of that. And why is it hard for them to trust? And how does that come up in their lives, et cetera? So you can make the pressured request for more information a window into the therapeutic process. Now, that's different from wanting to know, you know, what's your training? What are your credentials? It's not a matter of, trust me, I'm an authority. It's a matter of, you know, well, what is that authority based on? But that's quite different from wanting to assess the personal life details. The therapist may have, if you're going through a divorce and your therapist tells you that they've gone through a divorce, you may think that's comforting, but that may actually be problematical. That may seem to be comforting because, oh, this person will really understand me because they've been through the same thing as I have. It may be that the fact that they've been divorced could reflect problems that they have in their own life with trust and intimate relationships. And they may or may not be able to help you with your problems in that area. You know, if they've been divorced and they've done a lot of work on themselves and they understand a lot about the problems that arise in an intimate relationship, and, you know, that may help them. But your knowing that they were divorced or not is not evidence of anything that's necessarily helpful to you, other than reassuring yourself that they'll understand me.
Yeah, because I can see the quandary, because everybody comes in because they're in pain, right? Something's not, they're right. Not working in their life, which right. means they haven't been able to trust people necessarily, or they've had a series of bad judgments, and that they're not trusting their own judgments anymore.
Right.
So it's like, how can I like get comfortable knowing that the advice that I'm getting is constructive and is not, you know, a legacy of the next bad relationship or bad judgment I've chosen, you know? So it's like sorting that out. Like, can I be comfortable with this person? And over time, go ahead. You want to say something? Yeah.
Well, yes, because you said advice. And I think that's really an important assumption and misunderstanding. Everybody, particularly people who are naive about psychotherapy, I'm meaning not that they're stupid, but they've not had any experience with good psychotherapy.
Yeah.
Come to a therapist seeking advice. What should I do? A really good therapist says, in effect, why do you think I would know better what you should do than you know? Let's look at yourself, your distrust of your own judgment, because you've got much more data about you than I do. Even if we've spent 2 years together, you have more data about your life than I do.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's most people who haven't had this kind of therapy before come say, tell me what to do. And bad therapists will advise them. Well, have you tried this? Have you tried that? You know, et cetera, et cetera. what that perpetuates is what they brought to the therapy, which is seeking someone else to tell them what to do, which may be part of the problem that underlies their unsatisfactory relationships in the first place. They don't have enough self-confidence in their own critical judgment or decision-making or self-esteem, and they're looking for someone else to lead them. And that's what they do with the therapist. One of the keys is that ultimately, in insight-oriented psychotherapy, people do in the therapy the very same thing that they do that's problematical in their other relationships that has caused them the pain that brought them to the therapy. And that recognizing right. that is really critical to good psychotherapy. Yes. Rather than
yeah.
giving them a list of to-dos or try this, try that. You know, how come you won't, I asked you to do this. How come you haven't done it? You know, that's the problem, is that this person is always seeking advice, and then, you know, it may be victory through defeat. They don't follow the advice.
Right. Right. You know, that leads me into maybe the last part of our conversation here, which has gone into a wonderful, helpful direction. I think for a lot of people, your advice is so the best advice I've heard in a long time. So thank you.
Thank you.
I mean, your insights are just, I mean, that's what, you know, 4 decades worth of work in this industry can do for you. If you're really doing the work is, wow, you know, so this brings me to accountability and responsibility, both in the legal system. And I see this also, you know, so much with people. They say they want to get better. They read all the books, they go in and they get some help, but you don't see them really taking responsibility for their lives. Like they find ways in which they're scooting around what they should be doing and not really digging in deep and really saying, you know, I did this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I need to take responsibility for this. And mm-hmm. I feel like our legal system does nothing to help us be more accountable human beings.
Mm. Interesting. Yes. Let me ask you the question.
Okay.
What are you thinking of as an example of the legal system not helping us be accountable human beings?
Well, if we look at our past president, Donald Trump, you know, I have attorney friends who have said I've lost respect for the legal system.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so many lawyers that are, you know, congregating around him that have compromised their ethics. And, you know, are now like entranced into working with him you know, he just causes so much harm in wherever he is and recklessness. And I just feel like our legal system has gone so far away from the truth and accountability. And can you have justice? And is part of justice accountability, which is, is that a myth? Am I misunderstanding this? Why do people feel when they go through a legal process, they just don't feel like they're getting a fair shake?
I mean, that's a really broad question. And
yeah.
I'll try with my limited knowledge to do justice to it, to make a pun on what you're asking. The first thing is, I think, we have a former president who has no respect for the rule of law, but he's the chief executive of the nation, of the society. If you had a CEO in a company who was very paranoid, I'm not saying Donald Trump is, but just take that as an example.
Sure.
That filters down through the whole organization. Nobody trusts anybody. Everyone's worried that the person working under them wants their job, and the person above them thinks they want their job. There's great distrust in the organization. It filters down. Contrast that with a CEO who has great respect for everyone who works for the organization, who values human capital more even than capital, and says the most valuable assets in my organization are the people I've chosen to work with. That's a very different culture. So we, as a society, have had a chief executive who does not believe that the law applies to him. He disrespects the law. the rule of law is based on a group consensus that we are going to follow rules. There's no on high enforcement of the rule of law if the society doesn't agree that for all of our sakes, to reduce violence, if nothing else, when there's disagreement, we need a set of rules that we all agree ahead of time to follow. When the head of the society doesn't believe that at all, he believes in transactional, everything is transactional. What is in my best interest? And certainly if the law disagrees with what I want, it's not in my best interest. I'm going to use everything that I can buy to manipulate the law, which he did starting with Roy Cohen, who was ultimately a disbarred, very smart, but disbarred attorney to the mafia. That was his, you know, he said about his first attorney general, where's my Roy Cohen? You know, what kind of CEO wants a mafia consigliere to be his lawyer? You know, what does it say about his cynicism about the whole system of laws? So that's the first problem, is that the law and the judicial system is not going to protect our democracy or prevent dictatorship. Citizens are the only ones who can do that. Voting is the only way we can do that, becoming educated. And I think if enough people voted, the democracy is safe. Part of the problem is the cynicism that we feel, like your lawyer friends who say, I've lost respect for the law, understandably, that's a very dangerous sign, because they are in a sense, opting out of the societal agreement that we're all going to follow the rules. And I think that what we need to do now, this is my personal judgment, this isn't certainly medical or forensic psychiatric, is that no judicial decision is going to save the democracy. It's going to have to be citizens voting in numbers like we've never seen before to save the democracy, because that's where the democracy resides, is in our agreement.
So instead of sitting in disenfranchisement, mm-hmm. We should just make sure that we're talking with people and helping them get to vote.
Right. Yes. And it's so complicated because the country is so polarized. There really is an Earth 1 and Earth 2, and Earth 2 has alternative facts. They don't sort of accept science-based facts or evidence-based facts. They have only a group of emotionally based facts. We all are inclined to that as humans, but we kind of have to fight against that and say, despite my feelings, what does the evidence show? But people who have no respect for the evidence, because I know this is true because QAnon told me this, or because, you know, Donald Trump told me this, or said, that's a problem, is it? But I think that the majority of people do not think like that. The majority of people still have common sense, just like the majority of juries, despite the OJ trial, have common sense. And in most cases, it's really worth trusting a jury.
Okay. Yeah. That's really helpful to, you know, hear your insights into this. Well, and part of what plays into this, almost everyone I know has been affected with relationships that they've lost because of the extremism, where you can't have your own, you know, separate opinions and come together. And so I think as a society that part of what we're seeing about the cynicism is part of us are all still grieving the loss of really deep relationships that we've had with family. Me included. You know, it's been really sad to see that someone, you know, outside of ourselves can like have such influence that they totally obliterate, you know, our family. And a family has to be somewhat having some degree of dysfunction to reach that point. But, you know, ahead of all of, you know, pre-Donald Trump, you know, pre-2016 or so. Anyways, I just think that we don't seem to, as a society, we react to everything instead of like taking the time to like grieve the losses that we've accumulated along the way and not forget how much pain that was caused by this past president. And we're still sorting through it. And I don't hear enough conversations about that.
Well, I think there's a lot of conversation about mourning the loss of civility and the ability to disagree and still respect each other and discuss their differences and seek accommodation, although that requires an agreed view of reality, not two separate fact bases. Because in order to have a compromise, you need to agree on a common reality. You may have a different view of what is the good road to take or the less good road to take. And you also need to have goodwill and be seeking compromise and solution so that you can move forward and there's no ongoing conflict, let alone violence. We have now, for example, a House of Representatives that is an enactment of the country, which is basically you have a MAGA minority whose attitude is, if the Republican leader of the House of Representatives works with Democrats for any solution, let's say funding the government or foreign aid or whatever, if the fact that he has worked with the Democrats is dancing with the devil, and he should be kicked out because he has danced with the devil and betrayed his allies. That is inconsistent with a government where the role is to find compromise and get things done and move forward, not to punish someone for compromising. So we have the situation in our families where there are people who really can't discuss it with you because they know. That's the thinking of fundamentalism also, of any religion. You know, Muslim, Christian, Jewish fundamentalists is from God's lips to my ears. I know. You know, your God doesn't know, my God knows, and he told me. Usually he. Rarely she.
Right. Yeah.
And he told me, and you know, I've got the word. So why talk with you? You don't know. You haven't the received wisdom. That kind of mentality makes it impossible to have civil discourse and to govern if you're in the business of being a representative in the government. So I think this is a critical time right now, as we all say, but I think we have to look at beyond mourning the loss of civility and ability to get along with relatives who seem to have gone off the deep end from our perspective. We need to try and understand why is that appealing to some people to have a set of rules handed down or a view of reality handed down to them that they accept uncritically. What does that give them? And why is that appealing? Which is, every dictatorship is based on fear, the danger of the other. And there's usually one or more, whether it's, Islamophobia or whatever it is, it's the immigrants coming across, invading across the border. Even the country was built by immigrants, and some of the most impressive people in this country at any point in time in history have been immigrants. But they're invading us. They're a danger. They're the other. They're dehumanized by calling them the other. Therefore, you can do anything to them. You know, shoot them in the river, tear them up with razor barbed wire. It's fine, they're not really people. Why would somebody embrace that set of values? And I think it's because it's an answer to their anxiety about fear. fear about uncertainty, fear about things that have not gone well for them in their lives. And a charismatic leader says, you and I are aggrieved. We've been mistreated. You know, silver spoon in his mouth, Donald Trump has been mistreated. We, the aggrieved, now need to seek vengeance. And only I can protect you from those dangers out there. That's reassuring to people who don't think critically, who basically think with their feelings, feel afraid, have their fear fanned by this charismatic leader, and then are offered a solution. Follow me. I can keep you safe. Hmm. And that's going on right now. Forget about Donald Trump. It's going on in Israel with Netanyahu, who's unpopular, who's saying, only I can keep Israel safe from Hamas with my military strategy. I recognize how complicated the Middle East conflict is, and it's gone on for decades. But that's his message. Only I can keep Israel safe. And that's from the dangerous other outside who's out to harm, kill you, maim you, whatever. It's right out of the instruction manual.
The playbook.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I love all the conversations that I have with people. What I've particularly appreciate about what you brought to the table is an insight that is encouraging us to think about our legal system, about our behavior, about why we follow certain people, you know, all the different elements that really are causing us fear and anxiety. I've gotten some skills, and I'm sure the listener will too, and insights that will help me to make it through this year in a very constructive way. And hopefully we'll become wiser in who we're choosing as leaders in the future.
Thank you very much, Nancy. I really enjoyed the conversation with you and getting to know you a little bit as well. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you on your podcast.
Thank you so much. All right. So thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
If you want to expand your leadership skills and become more resilient and competent as a business owner, do you want to bring more meaning to your relationships and more purpose to your business? Are you ready to take charge of how you innovate, create, and run your business? Our dual innovation leadership process will help you redefine how you lead as you redesign your business. We collaborate with you to do what will work for you as you evolve and change. We start with where you are, whether you are turning around a financial crisis, growing to the next level, or somewhere in between. We address your immediate needs, shore up business development gaps, expand relational literacy, and build upon your entrepreneurial leadership skill sets with a short-term results orientation and a long-term perspective. Start by subscribing to this podcast at wementor.com or anywhere you listen to your podcasts. If you are ready to hire a mentor, contact me at nancy@wementor.com. When we mentor, you create better life and a more fulfilling future. As an entrepreneurial leader / innovator, as a competent business owner / practitioner, as a mentor / role model, and as a human being courageously living a meaningful life. As Gandhi said, be the change you wish to see in the world. Get involved today. It's never too late to change your life and how you lead.